This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about the Israeli offensive in Gaza and in Lebanon. And with me to talk about this is Jennifer Lowenstein, who spent time in both places and is, to my mind, one of the wisest observers of the region. Jennifer Lowenstein is a research fellow at Oxford's Refugee Studies Center. Jennifer Lowenstein, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much for having me on.
When were you last in Israel or Palestine or Lebanon?
I was there this June. I went on June 24th, and I was there for a week. And it was one of the most disappointing weeks I've ever spent there.
Why?
Because I was working this year on the background research for a book on the transformation of the Palestine National Movement from 1994 to 2006, which is basically a book on the rise of Hamas and the fall of Fatah. And prior to going, I had lined up a series of, to my mind, very important interviews with the Hamas leadership in the Gaza Strip, including with Ismail Haniyeh and Mahmoud Zahar, the prime minister, the foreign minister, and a number of other officials, and also others not in the Hamas party. And I got to Ben-Gurion Airport in Jerusalem on the afternoon of June 24th, and because of past things that I've written or having been known as an activist on this issue, when I handed my passport over to the immigration or customs person, I hadn't said a thing. She plugged my number into a computer, and within 30 seconds, I was surrounded by three security guards.
Well, you were on a list. How'd you react to that?
I was not terribly surprised. I knew sooner or later something like that would happen. It's the first time that's happened to me.
What did they do
and
with you?
They basically said, would you please come with us? It was all very polite. They ushered me away to what I called the holding pen, where there were a number of quote-unquote suspicious characters, all of them Arabs or Arab-Americans, I'm presuming, except another guy. I think he was an ISM person, International Solidarity Movement person. They got my luggage, and I was then ushered into a private room. I was strip-searched. I was interrogated, and everything in my luggage was gone through extremely carefully. Things were dumped out, toothpaste, baby powder, all kinds of things.
What kind of questions did they ask?
They asked me where I was going. They asked me why I was there. They asked me when I had last been there. And what was interesting about their questions was that I could tell that they weren't asking me because they wanted the answers. They were asking me because they wanted to see if I gave them the right answers. In other words, they knew the answers to the questions already. And indeed, I had gotten United Nations clearance to go to the Gaza Strip that week because it's very difficult to get into the Gaza Strip. I had clearance from UNSCO, the United Nations Special Coordinator's Office. And so there was supposedly not going to be any problem. So anyway, after 6 hours, basically, I was released. And by then, it was after 9 o'clock, and I could not have gotten into the Gaza Strip because Eretz, the main crossing, closes. I think it's between 8 and 9. So I went to East Jerusalem. I always stay at the same hotel there. It's a place called the Jerusalem Hotel. It's a lovely place. And actually met a couple of friends because I had that as a contingency plan. I knew it was possible I would stay there that night. The next morning, I got up very early, packed all my bags together, had some breakfast, and my cell phone rang. And it was the friend that I had seen the night before. And he said, Jennifer, you know, you may have a long wait outside Eretz today. There's been an attack at Kerem Shalom. And indeed, that was June 25th, the very morning that three members of various militias and factions in the Palestinian territories in Gaza had dug a tunnel underneath the strip and come up behind a security post, an Israeli security post near the Kerem Shalom crossing, killing two soldiers, wounding one, and capturing Gilad Shalit, who is now infamous. As a result of that event, Gaza was locked down for the week.
So you never got in?
I never got. Nobody got in. Nobody except, and I think this is also important, except select journalists, because today in the occupied territories, the Israelis are very careful about who they let in, so that you can't just be a freelance journalist, you can't just be a reporter from, say, the Progressive magazine. You have to be the full-time correspondent, Middle East correspondent, for a reputable, meaning meaning a mainstream news magazine or newspaper, such as the London Times or the New York Times.
Why do you think Hamas did the tunnel raid?
Well, first of all, we have to remember that it wasn't really Hamas that did it. There were three groups that carried it out. One is the Popular Resistance Committees, which is still quite radical, further to the left or the right, whatever you want to say, of Hamas. One was a new group called the Jaish al-Islam, which is the Army of Islam. And one apparently was a member of the military wing of Hamas, which is largely controlled by the outside leadership, from what I understand, in this case by Khalid Meshaal in Damascus. I understand that Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh had no idea that this was going to take place, and I believe that very much, because it was absolutely not in his interest or the interest of Hamas at all to carry out this attack. They were very much on the defensive at the time. The Gaza Strip had already been under siege for months, shortage of food, medical supplies, all of this.
And now it's really under siege. Why don't you talk about the Israeli response in Gaza?
Well, on the 25th, as I said, the crossing closed. And interestingly, I actually waited outside Eretz that day for 10 hours because there was some hope that they would open. And I was there with a couple of other reporters, somebody from the BBC and somebody from the London Times, who kept being told yes later on today. And so as we were sitting outside, we noticed up in the sky a huge sort of white surveillance blimp. And which I always find a little bit creepy, because you know almost everything you're doing can be watched.
And this looks like a Goodyear blimp or something?
Yeah. It was a little bit more high-tech looking. It was just sort of hovering in the sky overhead. And you also heard planes going into the strip. You could hear some of the aircraft overhead. And we were told, of course, that down in the Rafah area near Kerem Shalom, that it had gotten very tense, that there were a number of tanks amassing on the border. At that time, the Karni crossing, Kerem Shalom, the Rafah crossing, the Sufa crossing, and Eretz were all shut down. This is significant because, in particular, the Karni crossing is the main industrial crossing into the Gaza Strip, and all of the supplies, the humanitarian aid, goes through Karni. That had been shut down already for a number of months. The Israelis will sometimes selectively open the crossing to let in a trickle of humanitarian aid, just to keep the Gaza Strip sort of simmering on the brink of a humanitarian crisis, but not enough to sort of push it over the edge. So everything was shut down that week. And that night, Israeli warplanes bombed, two nights later, bombed the main electricity power plant in Gaza City, knocking out power to 750,000 people.
What's been the humanitarian effect of that?
Well, as you can probably imagine, it's been devastating. Even before the electricity was knocked out, you're talking about 1.5 million people, roughly 1.5 million people, 50% of whom, we should remember, are under the age of 20. We're talking about a very young population. John Pilger once referred to what's happening in the Gaza Strip as a war against children, because half the population is our children, basically. They're very young. There had been a severe shortage of food, of medical supplies, of educational supplies. Kids couldn't take tests because there wasn't paper to write write the tests out. The closure of the strip meant that the few people who were getting out through Eretz to work in Israel were not. Later on during the week, the strip was cut in half, meaning that people couldn't even travel from the south to the north or back. So that shut down more employment. With the bombing of the power plant, it's hard for people to imagine what it's like in the Gaza Strip. It's a densely populated region. It's a tiny region, about 22 miles long and 4.5 miles wide. As I said, about 1.5 million people. Desperately poor, terrible infrastructure. In other words, the roads are crumbling and falling apart. There are not great medical facilities as it is. And also in the summertime, it's horribly hot. It's not just, 95, 96 degrees, but you have about 90% humidity.
And do people usually have air conditioning?
No air conditioning at all. Very, very rarely does anyone have any air conditioning there, but fans. And, of course, refrigeration and anything that you can imagine that would make life a little more comfortable in the summertime when it's that hot and humid was suddenly not working. The cell towers were knocked out a lot of times by overhead drones. Electricity lines, phone lines were gone. You need electricity to pump water to the upper floors of buildings, and you have lots of these sort of cracker box high-rises, really poor high-rises. So people were not getting water. You had problems with sewage. In one case, about 2 weeks later, the Foreign Ministry building was bombed. And next to that building was the family the sister of a friend of mine and her family were living there. And in the middle of the night, you can imagine this bombing of the Foreign Ministry took place. And people forget that when you bomb a building, all of the buildings around it sustain damage as well, that there's a huge explosion. And in this one person's house, there was glass all over the floor and parts of the wall crumbled. And she had to get her family of 7 children out of the house. Her husband was not there at the time. In the dark, they had their feet were all cut up and scratched, and they were pretty banged up just getting out of the house. And this is the kind of thing that we don't hear about. It's not sensational enough because it's not an entire family dying under the rubble of a home. This is the kind of thing people are living with all the time.
You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. My guest today is Jennifer Lowenstein. She's a research fellow at Oxford's Refugee Studies Center. She's been to Gaza and to Israel and to Lebanon many times. She really knows what she's talking about in this area. Right now, Israel has captured or detained a whole number of members of the Hamas government, which is kind of an odd thing for one government to do to another. What is behind that?
Well, I believe the collective punishment of the Palestinians. What's important for people to remember is that on January 25th, 2006, after free and fair elections in the Palestinian territories, the Hamas party emerged victorious and basically are now in control of the government. One thing that I think most people don't realize is that a majority of Palestinians did not vote for Hamas. It's a very complicated voting system there. What you have is a dual voting system, popular representation as well as district voting. And so Hamas only won 44% of the vote, and 50% of that 44% were people protest voting, voting against Fatah. More individuals, however, voted for Fatah candidates and Fatah-affiliated parties than for Hamas. But because these parties were divided and splintered, they didn't have enough any one of them to be more than the 44% that Hamas got. So I'm trying to clarify that, because it is a misnomer that a majority of Palestinians favor Hamas. They certainly don't. Only a small percentage of those who voted for Hamas could really be described as hardcore ideologues, as people who really are Islamized, people who want to impose an Islamic state in Palestine. You will not find that among the majority of the people at all. Palestine is a very progressive area in the Arab world, probably the vanguard of the Arab world in terms of progressive politics, at least up until now. And we could see that changing, which I think is one of the tragedies of this whole episode.
Talk a little bit about then Hezbollah and Lebanon and the current crisis there. How did that start, and why do you think?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. Hezbollah, of course, one thing I should say is that both Hezbollah, which basically means Party of God is a term that actually has roots right in the Quran. There's a part of the Quran that refers to the Party of God. Both Hezbollah and Hamas are, to some extent, creations of Israel. Hamas formed as a political party within the occupied Palestinian territories in 1987. It grew out of the Muslim Brotherhood. And people like Sheikh Yassin, who was its spiritual founder, and people like Abdulaziz Rantisi wanted to have a more political role within Palestine. They were actually armed and funded by the Israeli secret police, the Mossad, the secret service, as a counterweight to the PLO. So once again, we see that there was some Israeli meddling in Hamas. The same is true of Hezbollah, not in the same way, but in 1982, when the Israelis invaded Lebanon, the Shiite population of South Lebanon actually greeted the Israeli invaders with a certain amount of jubilation. They viewed them as kind of liberators from the state within the state, from the PLO, from Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Liberation Organization, which they did not like. However, within weeks, the Shiite population began to be treated like occupied people, very, very poorly, indiscriminately bad. Everyone was treated just as poorly. And it was out of a reaction to the Israelis as occupiers that between 1982 and 1985, Hezbollah formed. It's a Shiite social movement, a political party, and as with Hamas, does also have a military element.
Now, it was this military element that did that cross-border raid, killing a couple Israeli soldiers
Yes.
and taking two prisoners.
Yes.
Why do you think it did that?
It did that for very clear reasons. In fact, one thing that we don't do in this country, which is really a shame, is we don't listen to what Nasrallah is saying. Hassan Nasrallah, of course, is the leader of Hezbollah. And basically what he said was that this raid had been planned for at least 5 months, that they decided to kidnap Israeli soldiers because in the past they had done this and had gotten Lebanese prisoners of war released by the Israeli government in exchange for the Israeli soldiers. They had done this in 2000 and again in 2004, but in 2004, at the very last minute, after German mediation, three of the most important political prisoners, Lebanese political prisoners in Israel, were held back. And these were three people, one of whom Nasrallah had personally promised his family that he would return to Lebanon.
But so he may have miscalculated here too, though, because Israel didn't respond in the way that he expected.
Certainly, well, it's difficult to say how much he miscalculated. From what people in Hezbollah have said, they did not expect the escalation that Israel immediately had, you know, that took out on Lebanon. They didn't.
Jennifer Lowenstein, why do you think Israel responded so heavily?
I think they responded very heavily for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is because for more than a year, probably since May of 2000 when they left South Lebanon, there have been contingency plans to go back into Lebanon to reestablish what they call a security zone and to ultimately change the regime in Lebanon. Since 1982, since before 82, it was the plan of the military leadership in Israel, certainly of Ariel Sharon, to install a government in Beirut that would be friendly to Israel, a government primarily of the right-wing Maronite phalangists at the time. And I think that there is a desire to have that done yet again, because Israel sees the Syrians, the Iranians, as a real threat to them. They certainly see Hezbollah as the arm of the Syrians and the Iranians, and they want to neutralize that threat by installing a favorable regime in Beirut and disarming the Hezbollah militia.
But that seems like a fantasy, that they're going to be able to install a government to their liking after what they're doing to that country.
Yeah, in fact, I think it was Yuri Avneri who wrote about how madness, one symptom of madness is when you try to solve a problem using the same method again and again and again, and each time it fails, and yet you do it again, and as if this time it's going to work. I can't read the minds of the people in power in Israel, but I don't see how it is possible for them to come out of this ahead.
Jennifer Lowenstein, can you read some of the consequences that have flowed from this overwhelming disproportionate Israeli response?
Well, one of the most severe and long-lasting consequences is that we are awakening a resistance that is pan-Arab, that is pan-Islamic, that goes across, that transcends national boundaries, that has as its vanguard, as its head, a Shiite Islamist militia and political party. In other words, it's not a left-wing, what we would call progressive resistance. It is an Islamist resistance. It has galvanized people across the Muslim and Islamic worlds, also and significantly within the Sunni Arab world as well. So you have not only popular support for Hezbollah in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iran, but also in Jordan, in Egypt and Saudi Arabia, allies of the United States, and within the Palestinian population. In fact, just for a very quick rundown, Hezbollah right now is supported by 100% of the Shiites of Lebanon, 89% of the Sunnis, 80% of the Druze, 80% of the Christians, 95% of the Christian Palestinians, 97% of the Sunni Muslim Palestinians, and you can see this widespread throughout the Arab world. It's enormous, and the consequences of this are going to be very long-lasting. Significant for one other reason. This is legitimate grassroots, homegrown resistance. This is not a displaced Al-Qaeda gang of people who basically had to leave their own countries and sort of build a psychopathic movement in exile. This is grassroots resistance, and it's going to flourish.
Well, for the governments that the U.S. has been propping up in Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Jordan or Kuwait,
they're nervous as hell.
Yeah.
They're very nervous.
They must be getting more security
guards. Well, and one of the reasons they're suddenly at the United Nations trying to step in and change the negotiations going on for a ceasefire is because they realize that their own populations are very unhappy with them and that their own populations are supporting Hezbollah.
What's it going to do in Iraq, the situation in Iraq?
I know Iraq,
al-Sadr has been not happy about it.
It's quite interesting what's going to happen in Iraq. I think that's anybody's guess. I've heard people here express, people in the know, I mean, express a kind of faint hope that the united front presented by Sunnis and Shiites in the Levant, in Lebanon and Palestine, could have some spillover effect within Iraq and lessen what has become a civil war. I'm not that hopeful. I think the civil war in Iraq has taken on its own dynamic.
But it would lessen the civil war only to the extent that it accelerates the anti-American
Well, exactly, and that's what I was going to say. I have a very difficult time reading the minds of the people in power. The United States has basically allied itself with the Shiite groups in Iraq. And these Shiite groups, of course, are the very groups of people, or the very people who are going to support Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. So while the United States is working against the latter three groups now in Lebanon and clearly favoring Israel, as they always have, the Shiites of Iraq are saying, wait a minute. And so this could have, again, some very serious repercussions in the long run.
Jennifer Lowenstein, what do you make? I know it's hard to understand what's in George Bush's brain.
What brain?
Might not be the longest archaeological dig either, but I'm wondering why you think the U.S. government gave Israel, as it clearly did, the green light for this Lebanon invasion.
I think there are enough people in the United States government who are deluded enough to think that they really can build, quote, a new Middle East, that they can really install regimes that are going to be friendly, compliant, favorable to Western policies. After all, they have been successful. Saudi Arabia is certainly a longtime ally, very corrupt. Jordan is a longtime ally. Egypt is a longtime ally. What is important, though, is that while these governments, at least Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, receive enormous military aid, financial aid from the United States, Saudi Arabia doesn't get financial aid. They don't need it. Their populations, and I mentioned this before.
They get military aid, though.
Yes, they definitely get military aid. Their populations are not necessarily supportive of the governments. And this is, of course, a big problem.
And it just seems to me, Jennifer, that no one in the U.S. government seems to understand that the images of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the bombing at Khanna, these other bombings that have killed dozens of people, already we have nearly 1,000 people dead, and the vast majority of those civilians and a huge chunk of those children. And the images of that going around on the Arab and Muslim TV networks is just stoking hatred, not just of Israel, but of the United States.
Well, and it's a good reason for allowing Al Jazeera to broadcast here in the United States, because you realize that most Americans are not seeing what the rest of the world is seeing. Even in the United Kingdom, where I was for a year, what we saw in television was far more graphic. And what people in the Arab world and the Muslim world are seeing is worse than that. And they get it a lot more than a half an hour at primetime news hour, or, you know, hour at 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock or whatever. So, yeah, it's really beyond me what on earth the Bush administration, and the Olmert administration in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, what they can possibly imagine is going to come out of this as good. They seem to believe that might makes right, that ultimately force will prevail. And that, I think, is going to be the most serious miscalculation of the whole war.
Your friend Robert Fisk of the London Independent wrote a column a couple of weeks ago saying that this is going to create another 9/11.
I think this is going to create multiple 9/11s, perhaps not on the scale of 9/11, perhaps greater. But I think you will see backlashes against Americans across the world. I think that they will eventually even take place again in the United States. It's very, very disturbing to me, very disturbing to see that. I was in Syria and in Lebanon as recently as last year, and again in Palestine just this June. And again, I have to stress that people knew very much that I was an American. They always asked, I always said, and I was always treated with the utmost hospitality, with kindness, with understanding. People almost routinely would say, welcome, you're welcome here. We know that the American people are not the same as the American government. And I was always so touched by that. I think that's going to start to change. We know that it's already changed in Iraq. And I think that it could start to change in other parts of the Arab world as well.
That's a harrowing way to end, but unfortunately we're out of time. So we can't put any happy wrapping paper on this one. Jennifer Lowenstein, thanks so much for being my guest today and shedding some real light on what is a very troubling situation.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.